is Me, Myself, and Disaster, the show all about disasters with a human focus. From hurricanes to humanitarian issues, we journey across fault lines to explore trends in disaster preparedness, response, and recovery. Over to you, Josh and Andrew.
Hello, and welcome back to Me, Myself, and Disaster, the show where we talk all things disaster with a human focus. In December 2022, Tropical Cyclone Ellie crossed the coast of Western Australia, bringing heavy rain, record flooding, and damaging winds to rural and remote communities across the Kimberley. Today on the show, we're going to explore the challenges of the recovery effort in more detail and some of the lessons learned from the event, particularly in relation to the community of Fitzroy Crossing. We'll discuss funding, the role of the mining sector in WA, community involvement in recovery, and some of the cultural considerations. Andrew, who's joining us on the show today?
Josh, we're joined today by Melissa Paxton, Deputy Commissioner, Strategy and Emergency Management at the Department of Fire and Emergency Services, or DFES, in Western Australia. Melissa has more than 20 years' experience in emergency management at a national, state and local level. She was previously the State Recovery Controller for Cyclone Seroja, which impacted WA in 2021, and prior to that, worked for the WA Local Government Association. We'll be asking Mel all about the recovery effort in the Kimberley and what this has meant for communities across the region.
Let's chat with Melissa Paxton here on Me, Myself, and Disaster.
Deputy Commissioner Melissa Paxton joins us now from Perth in Western Australia. Hi, Mel, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Andrew. It's an absolute pleasure to be with you both.
So I was in Fitzroy Crossing last year, and I have to admit, the impact was pretty devastating. I remember a meeting with an elderly man who had lived in the community for a long time. And like all disasters, he said, well, this sort of flood, I didn't think it would be possible. How is this possibly going to happen, or how did this happen? Can you walk us through exactly where Fitzroy Crossing is in the big scheme of things in Australia, why it's unique, and the immediate impact of that cyclone on the Fitzroy Crossing community?
Yeah, I certainly can. It is really interesting. Fitzroy Crossing is an incredibly remote town in WA. To give people perspective, it's about 400 kilometres east of Broome, and Broome is the closest regional city. However, it's also roughly about 700 kilometres from the Northern Territory. So it's quite hard for people who don't live in Western Australia to comprehend the size of our state. But to put it in context for the East Coast, it's actually shorter to drive from Sydney to Newcastle and back to Sydney than it is to drive from Broome to Fitzroy Crossing. So that tyranny of distance is really, really significant. The Fitzroy Crossing town site is surrounded by dozens of remote Aboriginal communities. And we refer to that town, if you like, and its surrounds as the Fitzroy Valley. And that's what the elders will talk to you about. And I guess in terms of impact, by the time the flood had reached the Fitzroy Valley, that tropical system, the actual cyclone, was no longer a cyclone. It had been downgraded to a tropical low. However, it was really slow moving and it just danced across the valley. And so the reality of that is that it just caused extreme heavy rainfall right over that valley area. And the elders will tell you that it felt like an angry flood. The water that was coming through that river was excessive and broke a number of records. And of course, the extensive damage to homes, infrastructure and community assets we'll get into. But it also meant that that town was isolated for quite some time. And across the broader region, we were effectively in a response and a recovery setting, dealing with three remote islands with the main focus, as you can appreciate, in the Fitzroy Valley.
And I was so surprised to be in Australia and thinking this place is so far from anywhere else. Like I remember I flew in there on a very small plane from Broome, and it was a couple of hours flight, and we were literally flying over just wetlands and swamps, and there are no shops. The highways are all cut off. There is literally nothing in between. If you need to go to Coles, it's a very long way to drive. So these people were really very isolated, and not just isolated by a small sort of river crossing, they put a boat across. This was serious. Isolated.
Yeah, it is. And I think in that is some inherent resilience in that community. You know, they are very much akin to the cycle and seasons of wet and dry. And they are used to a level of isolation that, as you just articulated, is probably foreign to most other people. So, you know, we're very lucky to work with people who do have an understanding of what that risk and what that isolation poses, but I think it's fair to say this one pushed the boundaries, even for those people who are accustomed to these sorts of events.
So one thing we want to start to get into is the recovery, because we think that there is a really amazing story in that a lot of practitioners and a lot of people, not only in Australia, but I think in Asia Pacific and around the world, can kind of learn from. Mm. And I think one of the key things that, you know, Andrew and I have spoken a lot about, you know, we've learned a lot around with our other guests and travels around the world, is that, you know, recovery is a journey. What recovery looks like on day one is not what recovery necessarily will look like in a couple of years, in 3 years' time. But can you talk us through what was that immediate priority, or what was that immediate need? What did that look like in the community on day one for you guys?
Yeah, so I think for listeners, it is probably important to touch on the fact that over in WA, I have a responsibility for recovery as the Deputy Commissioner, but I'm also housed within the agency that is also responsible for response. And so, you know, all of us recovery nerds will know that recovery starts at the same time as response, and we get to live and breathe that, right? So my team, amazing recovery practitioners, from the time the response starts, are embedded in those structures and systems. And I think that is an incredible opportunity for us in WA, because the decisions and the observations we can make during response and building those relationships from day one with community help us to inform those recovery needs. So to your question, I guess, Josh, is that we recognised very, very early on that the isolation piece, the ongoing sort of risks and vulnerabilities. So most people who have dealt with floods before know that there is that time frame where you're building up to it. Then in this case, we had some record-breaking sort of numbers that occurred. But obviously, as those waters recede, you really get a better picture of what that really looked like. So of course, our primary focus was making sure that people were safe. We also had to evacuate a number of people from their homes, and we will probably touch on this a bit more, but of course, when you're dealing with remote Aboriginal or Indigenous First Nations people, it is really important to recognise that connection to country. Mm-hmm. And so not only are you dealing with the sort of normal, you know, I say that in inverted commas, recovery things around safety, homes, do you know what I mean? Trying to make sure that people feel safe, you're also dislocating then in a spiritual and cultural sense from something that really is integral to their own well-being. So we, from the get-go, were very, very conscious of that. And I think as we uncover this story, the role that those traditional elders played, along with us recognising that we probably needed some additional support and employed cultural navigators to help us really navigate that tension point between making sure we do what we should be doing, but also doing it in a really, really culturally sensitive way. So I think, you know, normal early priorities certainly played the normal part, but a real, real focus on making sure we were translating information at that early stage of response relief, even as we headed into short-term or sort of the first stage of recovery, into proper languages, making sure we were going out, making sure we could engage to really understand what those needs were going to be.
I just want to touch a little bit on that spiritual piece, because I think it's an interesting thing. It's something that obviously we don't talk too much about in emergency management. And I think you've touched on a really important thing, and I'm interested to hear in this aspect, because I think if you think a lot of emergency management agencies, working in the government space are probably, you know, working more in that secular space, but then obviously working with communities like First Nation who have a deep spiritual connection to land. What did that look like for you guys? How did you bridge some of those gaps where, you know, again, government agency, I'm here to meet my outcomes, meet our budget, make sure we get things back to normal in inverted commas. But again, yeah, how did you navigate that journey where you're dealing with an extremely spiritual community with deep connections to the land?
Yeah, I think as government workers, you've touched on it, we like to follow the bouncing ball. I am incredibly passionate about communities. The thing that draws me to this work, I think about for all of our, I'm going to keep saying it, our recovery nerds, the national principle, the first one is understand the context, right?
Yep.
So for me, it doesn't matter if I'm working in the Fitzroy Valley and there is that spiritual, cultural connection, or where I've had the privilege of walking into the Midwest for Cyclone Seroja, 16 local governments impacted. You know, their spirituality is football. Like North Nabden are all about the AFL, and that will probably tell you about that, right? So I guess I'm generalizing, but I want to make the point that we sign up to these national principles, which is really about understanding who has just been impacted. And so what that looked like in Fitzroy Valley, I like to touch, feel, smell, understand. I sat under a tree on the Fitzroy Valley Oval and talked to traditional owners. That's what we did. We sat there and we listened and we let the response mechanism around us happen. The incident control centre was just across the road. We had regional operational centres operating from Broome, but I positioned myself and members of my team close to the evacuation centre where we could sit and listen. And the community spoke loud and clear that they saw this as an opportunity for them to engage and really think beyond not only what they needed, but what this opportunity presented. And I have to say that that was actually quite different to other secular communities, to use your word, Josh, than I had been in. They genuinely understood what this meant. And of course, to your question around the spirituality, it wasn't a conversation that was ever going to be what we've seen in other jurisdictions around you know, this river's going to flood again. This isn't a buyback situation, right? This is my home. This is my country. These are my stories, and that is going to be there for, you know, generation on generation on generation. So those sort of guide rails were set really early by that community. Mm.
In terms of the recovery process, the Aboriginal and Indigenous-owned businesses, I understand, certainly played a particularly important role in that recovery process. What have they? What's that process been look like, and how have these businesses played that role in building resilience in that community after this flood event?
Yeah, so I think it's really important, the point I just made, that the Aboriginal people themselves could see opportunities for their people. Yeah. Mm. And so this was a really large part that we wanted to harness. To have communities stick their hand up and say, we want to get involved, you don't turn that down at all. So when this journey began, as I said, we established what is known as the Fitzroy Valley Working Group, and it was their recovery working group. They also brought on board business owners to initiate conversations with state government and the Commonwealth government around what that might look like. So we actually utilised the DRFA through a Category C and or D, don't quote me, it's one of those, package, whereby we used it as an empowered and enabled model for Aboriginal businesses to engage in the works that need to be undertaken. The numbers speak for themselves, guys, I have to say. So we had more than 90 Aboriginal businesses that were contracted to deliver recovery works. 75 of those are actually based in the Kimberley, so not even the Pilbara or neighbouring regions. And collectively, these businesses have delivered more than $90 million in secured contracts.
Wow.
Now that is like career highlight right there. And really what the people really wanted to do is get involved, show leadership to their community. They're a really proud mob, I have to say.
Yeah.
And they recognised that it wasn't just about them. There were some businesses that actually initiated that have been looking and have done training. Now, we have been working really closely, once again, seed funding. You know, that all came down to that social piece and the role model leadership piece of these Aboriginal people going and collecting people, getting them ready for work, training them, understanding what the expectations are. And we held some deadly jogs expos as well. So we're up to our third one already. And that's been a really good opportunity for not only Aboriginal employment and economic advancement, but it's been a really good place where anyone who's got jobs on offer or training opportunities can come together and have those face-to-face conversations.
I'm thinking about, and it's the same thing in other jurisdictions, when you have these big events and the capital city has all the resources, all the emergency services who fly in and fly out and that sort of thing happens. What do you think, and I guess I'm asking that the contrast between what we saw in Fitzroy Crossing in terms of the recovery using local businesses and local people, hypothetically, how do you think that went compared to if we would have used, say, people from Perth flying up there to provide a contracted service?
I don't think the community would have stood for it. Yeah. is the reality of that situation. Look, I think most governments across all jurisdictions sort of tend to lean towards a, you know, buy local in my context, sort of policy. This was just making sure we honoured it.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, I think, again, recovery principles, right? When we can get our communities involved and engaged, we see these amazing outcomes. And I think, you know, we needed to recognise that there was a will. It was then around what are the wraparound supports we can provide as a state government in concert with the Commonwealth government to really ensure there was an enabled environment for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was done in a very supportive, sort of taking a strengths approach to the challenge at hand, which the community pretty much laid at my feet in the first couple of weeks.
Yeah, yeah. I just don't want to gloss over a moment because I think there's a real critical learning moment here. You were talking about, you know, some of the structures you set up around, you know, recovery working groups and groups in the community to, you know, to bring stakeholders together. And to be really honest with you, you know, I look at that and kind of go, yep, that's a pretty universal thing in recovery. We all know that, you know, we need to set up our groups. We need to provide spaces for those stakeholders to come in it. But what I'm hearing out of your story is it wasn't necessarily the structures, but it was having the right people in the right roles to have the right conversation. So can you talk a little bit through that around, you know, because again, most governments and most people listening would go, yeah, yeah, we've set up a recovery working group, tick, done. But again, I've seen a lot of them fail because it hasn't been the right people in the right role. What are you guys doing in that space to ensure that you're having those right people that can actually execute within those, you know, governance structures?
Yeah. So the Fitzroy Valley itself is quite complex. Just like any community, there are politics, there are challenges, there is a whole raft of things. We built that structure with the consent of those players, if you like.
Yeah.
So we recognised that we needed to use, I guess, the best structure to try and ensure that they could participate, advise. And we built the, if you like, terms of reference, I guess, in want of a better term, and their charter around the strengths that they could provide.
Yeah.
Because I think it's fair to say to your point, Josh, we've all got the manual.
Yeah.
But we know that one size does not fit all. Mm. Yeah. So we also recognize that in our state, like many, I'm sure, that, you know, the local government has responsibility for recovery in our legislation. But funnily enough, that tyranny of distance that I discussed with you earlier meant that there was a bit of a disconnect when we first arrived, certainly that we observed, that meant that that traditional one-size-fits-all local government are going to stand up a local recovery coordination group. They're going to, you know, go and get the players from the Fitzroy Valley. It just wasn't going to roll.
Yeah.
So building that Fitzroy Valley piece as a advisory group, I think it's important to say they weren't decision makers. Mm. So they were advisory to the other pieces of the sort of governance structure. So they knew that they had a direct advisory role to both local and state government. Yep.
Yeah.
So they knew the power of that, I think, which really enabled them to be frank and fearless in terms of what they were looking for. And it was the appropriate blend for representation of all of those different remote Aboriginal communities in the valley so that they nominated the leads so that they had trust and confidence in the person representing them to advise government on what that looked like. So, again, locally led, even three layers back, if you keep peeling the onion, those communities were able to nominate the person that they felt was best going to represent them. And as you can appreciate, that makes for some really fascinating and challenging conversations.
Yeah.
But, you know, better that we have those conversations there, come to a unified position and advise government for the decision-making aspect of that.
I was about to say, I think the more and more Andrew and I have been in this industry, but again, as well, doing the podcast and talking to a lot of people around the world, there's been this really clear theme of do not be afraid of robust discussion. That is where this comes from. And you're not going to get the best outcome unless you actually have that opportunity to have that robust discussion and not be afraid of it, especially as a government agency, to actually lean into that and actually invite that robust discussion onto your front doorstep and work through that. Because you're right, if not then where? Where is that ever going to happen and how are we going to get that best outcome?
Yeah, and I think, there is a concern. Mm. And I think there's been, in my observation in terms of recovery, I hope we're coming out the other side of this immediacy.
Yeah.
I think that the immediacy and this expectation that we have the answers on day three does everyone a disservice. I think there is this notion that we have to make an immediate decision and we have to announce big numbers. I can tell you now that, you know what it's like yourself, trying to process the complexity, navigate your way through, responses still taking place. I was very clear that we would take the time necessary for that community to get their head around this and start providing some advice to couple with the normal processes of recovery around impact and need. Yeah?
Yeah.
And I think your point, Josh, those robust conversations taking place before the announcements,
right,
is critical.
Yeah.
Because then you've got everyone lined up. Then you know going into that what that collective is going to need to be committing to. It's not just a response from government.
Yeah.
It is actually more of a unified sort of position that we're all moving towards, or call to action, if you like, in terms of what that means. I think that's really critical.
So longer term then, I really like to understand, because you were just unpacking before, you know, around some of that First Nation economics, having those First Nation economic principles around using local, but truly using local, not just using, oh, because it's a First Nations company, but let's actually look at First Nation companies on country in place. What are some of those kind of longer term metrics that have come out of that that you guys have witnessed in the community by taking that approach with those businesses?
Yeah, look, I think pride is one thing, and we can't measure that in spades. But look, very early on, we had even the police force coming to us and saying, you know, in all social sort of indicators, everything's on the up, right? So we've got people in jobs, we've got kids at school. There's some newspaper articles online about the police sort of talking about that. And we appreciate that there is always a honeymoon phase through some of these things.
Yep.
We've released three videos that have sort of talked to this journey, which I'm sure we can share the links with you to
Definitely. Put
in your show notes. And the last one we've just released is around this advancement piece. And the reason I start with pride is because the overwhelming, I have to say, I did have a bit of a cry when I watched it for the first time. People are proud, you know, they're standing on that bridge, and every time they drive past that bridge, they're saying to their kids, I helped build that bridge, right? Like, how do you get to ever say, I've got to build a bridge in Fitzroy Valley, you know?
Yeah.
That's not a job that appeared on the jobs board prior to the floods. So I think in terms of that resilience and that pride, and coming back to what I've said all along, is there was just this genuine observation by the community that this was a massive opportunity for them. GYU, who is one of those groups that I talked about in terms of training, that is really significant. That is a business that is going on and on. And if you follow them on Facebook, you know, they're past the blood, you know, putting pictures up of people who are graduating with Cert 3s and 4s and have gone from the bridge onto some of the mining companies and things like that. So I think the engagement in the economic space has been incredibly important for that community in terms of just really enabling them to go from strength to strength.
The community empowerment stuff is, I think, we know about it, I feel, but a lot of people, when it comes time to a response or the recovery from a disaster, we're so busy, as you mentioned, doing everything else that you go, okay, we'll do it if we can, but we'll try and get like people back into homes or into evacuation centers. We'll try and get the water and the electricity back on, that we sometimes forget that sort of stuff. And listeners will know that Joshua and I have been on a 3-month trip around the world looking at disaster sites, and a place like New Orleans, where they're still almost 20 years on, houses that are just been abandoned and boarded up because they can't be lived in, and there's people just can't go back there. This feels like it's moved at a pretty quick and relatively quick pace in terms of the recovery process. But I'm wondering, in terms of lessons learned from this event, do you think any lessons from, I guess, using local and empowering communities in particular could be applied to a disaster in another part of Western Australia, for example, or other parts of the world?
Look, I really think there is, but I'm also really mindful of the bar that's been set in this particular recovery. And I just want to bring it back to that first national recovery principle about context. Mm. You know, there were existing underlying what we would call vulnerability, right, in our sector in that place, which included things like underemployment. And the reality of this was that most of the assets that were damaged were state government assets. We knew that there were levels of underemployment. So if you just take even those two touch points, we're talking about ownership from the state of those assets and we're talking about opportunities for employment, right?
Yeah.
So I don't want to use the word control, but there were certainly things that we could influence as a state government and then leverage some of that for the improvement. I have to say the thing that keeps me awake after this one is that, you know, I have been involved in some of our other large-scale recoveries in the last sort of 3 years. Now, if I go back to Seroja, for example, those vulnerabilities were different, yeah? So, you know, would that workforce be available? Maybe not, yeah? Most people, yes, they were insured. They were underinsured, so I don't want to underestimate that. It was the first time in a long time a cyclone had come through that community. But there were different levels of resilience in there, yeah? So, look, we're incredibly proud of the Fitzroy Valley. We're very proud to say that just last night or just yesterday we actually won an award for collaboration across state government agencies and the like. So I'd never want to downplay the effort there. However, I do just keep coming back to that first principle, you know, that I think as recovery practitioners, and I say that because if you haven't practiced and you're following a bouncing ball off a manual, you don't get to apply the lessons that you've learned. I think that there's always stuff you learn in these things that can be applied elsewhere, but you've got to check yourself, don't you?
Yep.
And make sure that you're really curating the next recovery around what's in front of you and what is actually meaningful to that community so that we can, you know, reinstate, if not help them flourish, as we've done in Fitzroy, to try and get that balance right.
And one more question about community empowerment, because over in the United States, where I've just been recently, they have, I guess, a different model in terms of there's no government massive army of volunteers going to turn up and help like we have in Australia with the SES and the fire services and those sorts of things. They do rely heavily on those faith-based groups, volunteering organisations like Team Rubicon, but also the private sector has this massive role in providing aid and support and resources and assets, which I don't think we have in Australia to the same extent. But also, when I've been in Western Australia before, seeing the impact of mining companies who are massive in Western Australia and provide so much to the economy, let's not talk about climate change impacts, we can cover that later, but they have a huge impact in terms of resourcing the economy and providing that help post-disaster. I saw dongers or shipping containers being dropped off and resources and donations, all that sort of stuff. To what extent does that private sector or mining company input help in the recovery process?
Yeah, really interesting. We have been really lucky that I think in WA there is quite a close working relationship between those companies and government, local governments and the community sector. I think, you know, we won't touch the climate change bit, but certainly in remote parts of Western Australia, they are a real dominant force in terms of the community presence. And also some of those communities actually wouldn't exist if there wasn't that mining capability in that area. So, you know, I think there is a healthy relationship there. We definitely were lucky enough to get some support from a number of those mining companies. So you're right, Andrew, we had, in terms of our sort of medium temporary accommodation, we had dongers donated, which we then utilised through our Department of Housing, Department of Communities to really think about how could we use those in, again, a culturally sensitive way. And that was a really big help because at the same time we were coming off the back of some of the floods on the East Coast. And so, you know, WA is very far away as we've established and we're all competing for the same sorts of resources and supplies. So to have that relationship with some of those private sector, mining companies and the like, other industry is really important. We really encourage that in our preparedness phase. So just this week, we've been online with all of our district emergency management committees and we got a briefing from the Kimberley, again, in Broome, you know, and they have a subgroup, for example, at their DEMC, which is industry representatives. It's actually chaired by one of those mining companies, and they are really bringing to the table their understanding of risk, but also what they can do to support those communities. So I think it's equally as important, you know, as always, we can pick up a phone in the heat of battle, but having those relationships early and thinking about how they can help front of mind as we head into these seasons is also really, really important.
Look, I just want to change gears a little bit here and take ourselves a little bit away from on the ground and want to just step into the leadership space for a while, because I know, Mel, you're obviously an extremely respected leader in the recovery space, obviously in WA, but I know obviously with my time at NEMA, you're respected right across Australia in terms of some of the work that you've done and you've led. You were talking a little bit earlier around, you know, that notion of, you know, being able to, as a leader, create space, you know, push back, create room, you know, deal with that political realm, tell the why, help people understand, tell the story. Can you talk us through in this element, you know, what were some of those kind of key leadership lessons that you learned in that discovery space, especially around how you kind of help government obviously achieve their outcomes while still getting the best for community with creating space?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. So I'm going to start with, you have to have a good team around you. And I think we were really blessed in this. We, like many other jurisdictions, for these large scale emergencies, appoint a state recovery coordinator or controller outside of our normal arrangements. I do want to make mention of Rob Cossart and Grant Pipe, who equally stepped into the realm. Both have experience in the Valley and have experience across that sort of northern part of Western Australia. And in terms of the interface, were incredible in terms of bringing together, you know, this broader recovery piece. And I think it's really important to acknowledge then. I normally get the piece at the beginning, and once they've all left, I get the piece at the end. and to your point, I think my North Star, my core value is always thinking about how do I create space for the community for me to understand. And I have to be honest, I find it very hard to advise government, I'll call it my hand on my heart moment, if I haven't got down on the ground and understood it. Now, that is not to say, as we alluded at the beginning, recovery is a moving feast, and what happens on day one looks very different from, you know, day 30 through to day whatever, 365 and beyond. However, the bit that I'm looking for when I'm on the ground in those first few days is really about community. It's really about, are there leaders, are there not leaders? You know, how impacted are they? How what are those underlying vulnerabilities that are going to make this hard? Yeah. And I know we're not on video, but I've got my hand in the air thinking, how do I keep messaging above to create that space? Okay. So given that we are housed in, you know, all in one for DPES, recovery and response, I get a little bit of a window because the attention is on response. And I like to use that really, really wisely, because responders are great. First responders are great. You know, government agencies will be briefing twice a day. So there's a lot of activity in that space. I cannot tell you how important as a recovery practitioner it is to find a way in so that you can be under the forest floor while all that activity is going on around you. Because in our case, if I take Seroja, 6 weeks of response. If I take Kimberley floods, you know, we were talking a good, again, 5 to 6 weeks. That's gold in recovery terms, right? Absolute gold. So how can you be establishing some relationships, working out that community mapping? Yes, understanding the need, but there's a lot of noise going on. And then when you're coming out of that, for me, there's an opportunity then to be able to brief in as if we've got some stuff sorted. Does that resonate?
Yeah, no, I think it's really important because, you know, obviously both of our careers have spanned across all levels of government, and it's not a problem, but it is a challenge that we, you know, every practitioner in this government space works with. And I think you're 100% right is that, you know, I really like that analogy of, you know, going undercover while the battle's going on overhead and be able to grab your space. Because you're right, like days, hours, weeks, you know, time is gold. Time is money at the end of the day. And being able to get a front foot forwardness on that is really important. One thing I just wanted to quickly touch on as well in terms of, you know, moving forward, what are some of the challenges Fitzroy Crossing? Because I know, obviously, it's not all bright and shiny. You know, there will always be issues that are ongoing in communities, and we always need to keep an eye on those, and we always need to look for continual support and continually working with those communities. What are some of those challenges now in the community that you feel are some things that you know, not necessarily your team, but maybe broader government are working with that community on?
Yeah, so I think we were really conscious that, you can plan all this out, you can have all these meetings and you can, get this magic spot, right? I wonder if this is ever going to happen again in my career, I've got to be honest. You can hit that sweet spot. And then it dawned on us that have we created something where there may be a cliff base that when we ultimately, which you want to be able to do in a community development model, step back and they continue, have we created a cliff? The recovery domains, which most jurisdictions use, we really stood that up in awe this time round. And what we found was that we've been able to work with those government agencies through that domain sort of process to consider next steps so that there isn't the cliff base where we say, right, there's 2 years or 3 years and we're packing up and see you later, demobbing, so to speak. We've actually been able to, across government, think about projects that have got a longer life and stagger some of those ongoing projects. So if I take, for example, our main roads department, they've been fabulous. We've got all these trained workers who have assisted with the bridge. So they've actually just, at the last budget round, announced a 3-year program of work for regional roads and even things like if you've worked in Aboriginal communities before, orphan assets, so orphan roads, all of those things. So I think that's been really really well received, so that ultimately, I always draw the sort of picture at those first 6 weeks when you're under the forest floor of, yes, we come in, and when you've got that big community map, if you think of lots of circles and all of the connections, and then if you put a big green one in the middle, which is almost like your recovery team comes in, ultimately you want to be able to take that green circle out and that network and those things are actually operating without you, yeah? And so I think across government, that's been a really good success story for us, Josh, in terms of thinking about how do we stagger the green dot coming out? How do we endure some of those other things and leverage it away from the flood? Because the community also tells me, and I'm sure your previous people on your podcast have said to you, people get sick of talking about recovery too.
Yeah.
Right? So yes. Like, okay, can we stop talking about that flood? Because actually we're all wanting to talk about, I don't know, whatever's next. So I think that's really important. I think the ongoing challenges there is that, I think that the in transitioning from recovery, I think it's going to be a real testament to those leaders that had that foresight to think about, how do those other relationships endure to continue those operations? And I think that will be probably the true test for that community as they move forward.
Yeah. It's been some years now since Cyclone Seroja has gone through and we've had this other cyclone up north. Are there any, key lessons in terms of that building back better, using traditional knowledge or building practices in terms of the way we sort of build these communities back, particularly in the north of the state? Have there been any sort of key lessons learned? I mean, the first one was a cyclone that came through in an area that wouldn't have normally said, oh, this is a cyclone risk. Are there any thoughts around what might have or what's been done to, build back better with that knowledge and what we know now from these disasters?
Yeah, look, I think in terms of just literally the built form, we have a relationship with James Cook Uni, which most of you do, Cyclone Testing Station. We have an MOU with them. So we did some really good work and draw on expertise, all the time, wherever you possibly can. Tip number one, where they had done a post-impact assessment. And we've been really lucky. We have been able to make some changes through the building codes to the wind ratings in Geraldton. Once again, context, people probably weren't insured for a cyclone. We recognise, though, that those who were, we built a DRFA program for that event, that where you were insured, you could get some access to a resilience and recovery grant that could actually help with the advice of Cyclone Testing Station and James Cook around some of those resilience measures. Now, I will say that was pretty clunky in the first instance. However, you know, it was a step for us in WA towards some of that more resilient impact work as you move forward. And look, the uptake on that was varied, I'll be honest. But I think it's really important to take those steps and sometimes just give those things a try. And you, of course, you learn from that. You learn what does that look like. But I think in as we move forward, clearly land use planning, you know, building codes, all of those things are going to be really critical to help assist our communities who are faced with these sorts of natural disasters.
Look, Mel, Andrew and I could talk about recovery for hours and hours and hours.
Oh, I have a list here. I want to come in on the second podcast, talk about climate change and mining companies, the cost of rising, all those with insurance, and I want to talk about negotiating with the Commonwealth around disaster funding. But that's for next time. So, so many lessons to learn.
but I think it is a testament to, yes, we have learnt so much in this space, but there is so much to go. There is so much to still learn. And like anything, the world around us, humanity at its principle is always ever changing. So therefore, the recovery landscape will always change. And the things that we do and the strategies we put in place, like you said, and if I had to articulate back, I really like this notion of, you know, the lessons learned aren't about how we did it. It's about why we did it and coming back to first principles. So thank you so much for your time today. But before we wrap it all up, there's one thing we're really passionate about this show, and it's that, you know, emergency management, it needs to be sadly a growing industry because of the threats that we're facing in the future. And from a career perspective, and our listeners know, Andrew and I bang on about this a lot, that it's not necessarily a career thing or a career pathway that many think about. So one thing we always like to kind of finish up a show with is really understand where and how our guests found themselves in these positions and in these spaces so other people can identify within themselves a similar pathway. So Mel, for you, how did you get into this line of work and how did you become passionate about disasters and recovery?
Yeah, I'm passionate about communities and I'm fascinated by government. If I had a slogan, that's what it would be.
I feel like I've got to make Mel a jumper with that on there. Ultimate recovery nerd.
Absolutely. I grew up in a household that were community volunteers, cricket, footy, dancing clubs, you name it. So service was always part of my mindset. I was doing a teaching degree. I applied for a job at the, well, it was a different name, but let's call it DFES. My very first job here was a level 2. So I think the bottom of the rung, everyone listening. A schools educator, and I used to take school groups and community groups through our old Perth fire station and educate them on what they would do if they got caught in a house fire. I was just taken by the notion that there is always, I'm a huge believer that everyone has an element of resilience, and it is our job to allow that person, community, region, whatever, the privilege of standing in their own empowerment, and then we need to meet them where they are and help them through the next bit that's always challenging. This emergency management marries my passion for community. I love complex problems. I'm a bit of a, I don't know, crazy like that. I love navigating complexity because I think at the core of all of that just comes back to those first principles and humanity. And when you sign up in government to become a public servant, which can sometimes have a really bad name, I don't see that any different to volunteering in your community or doing any of those other things. We're here to help each other. Yep. We're here to really support people. And what an absolute privilege it is to do that and see people at both their best and at their worst.
It is really about solving problems, isn't it? It's just such a fascinating industry to be in when these problems are so difficult. And going around the world, it's all we heard was just how it's about solving problems one after the other and just getting these communities back to a place where they can function again. And it's just such a fascinating place to work, doing all this sort of community space and the recovery. And, I mean, response is exciting, but it is ultimately about solving problems and how we continue to look forward to new and better ways of doing things. So, Mel, fascinating discussion, and really appreciate you joining us podcast today. We have shared a link to the recovery website in the show notes and some of those links to the videos that you've mentioned. So if you're interested in learning more, check those out. We've also put a few photos on our website at me-myself-disaster.com as well as on our social channels. Melissa Paxton, thanks for joining us on Me, Myself and Disaster.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's all we have time for on the show today. Join us again next time as we talk to more interesting guests from across the world about their experiences during disasters. We'll catch you then.
Thanks for listening to Me, Myself and Disaster. Subscribe today at memyselfdisaster.com.